I'm Kirsty McKenzie, founder and chief exec of iMultiply, a finance and executive search business. And today I am joined by David Watt. David is the executive director of the Institute of Directors and an experienced non-exec director. David, welcome to the iMultiply sofa.
Real pleased to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. You're very much a key player in the Scottish business scene. So tell me, if you don't mind, David, what do you think are currently sort of the common challenges that are being faced by, you know, small to medium-sized companies in Scotland at the moment?
Recession, really, we've seen effectively in the oil and gas industry in Scotland, has kicked out all across Scotland. I get a bit fed up with people saying it's just happening in the northeast of Scotland. It is absolutely not, because I know many of our members in central Scotland supply widgets or whatever it may be to the oil and gas industry and have been doing so for years. We're all tooled up to do that. Mm-hmm. And when the oil and gas relative recession in the North Sea came, the decline in price has been a real big impact. And I think that's only just rolling out in Scotland. The figures for the last quarter, which were astonishingly good, actually, of 0.8% growth. So it showed that we might be getting there. But it's largely, I think, in services. It's largely in financial services. So for small businesses, yeah, it's really challenging.
Do you think there's anything positive that's coming out of the current, you know, economic or political climate?
Yeah, I think there's one very practical thing, which is interesting, that anybody who sells services abroad is basically making 20% more than they made last year because of the decline in the pound. So that's very, I know several firms who are bluntly raking in millions of pounds for doing not a bit more work. So that's a real, where you're not having to buy in raw materials. That's the downside. Raw materials are expensive. And if you can't sell them back out into that 20% greater increase, you're taking the hit yourself, or else you're having to put your prices up, which in some markets is just not possible. And that's the sort of good side for some people making lots more money. But the second thing I think that's been amazing, actually, through probably 5 years of elections and referendums in Scotland, almost continuously, business has thrived and survived despite it all. So it sort of reflects the fact that business people are just really determined, generally very well focused on what they're actually trying to do, and they just got in with it. So the sort of political bit of that doesn't really bother them. I mean, they're not interested in what Theresa May or Nicola Sturgeon are doing today or tomorrow, unless it's very directly about taxation or things that concern the economy. That's my job to be aware of the wider context, but most business people are just getting on and doing well, and the resilience and determination has been fantastic.
It's interesting to hear your view on that, because we deal a lot with entrepreneurial high-growth businesses, and certainly that's what I've seen and heard as well, is that people are just getting on with it, and actually, if they're a dynamic business, they are not afraid to change and see opportunities in times that maybe aren't always as positive.
Well, but absolutely.
There is a good buzz, isn't there, in Scotland with regards to especially the food and drink and some of the technology startups.
There is a sort of continuation. Food and drink has really started to go well, obviously, particularly whiskey, but salmon and prawns and everything, and beef and such. So there's all that massive industry growing very well, Stornoway black pudding and all that sort of thing. It's done brilliantly. And that is a good bandwagon to jump on. And we've seen more distilleries open in the past 2 or 3 years than we've probably seen for a century. It's just been astonishing. And the other slight irony is that distilleries employ less people than the visitor centres they attract as well, sort of thing.
And so tell me a bit more about the Institute of Directors and your role specifically within the organisation.
Yeah, well, we have 1,850 members in Scotland. What's interesting, just following what we said, they're from all different industries, large and small. We probably have about 15% who are on the way up as one-person businesses and growing, and then we have 10-15% at the other end who are in the bigger businesses of Scotland, employing literally thousands at Babcocks, at Bank of Scotland and so on. Our job, fundamentally, very simply, is to support and help directors.
Let's talk about board development. Because as a business, iMultiply place a number of people into small to medium-sized companies at board level. And I guess I want to hear from you about, does board development actually happen?
It's a good question. The answer is certainly not as much as it should. I genuinely believe that every organisation in Scotland would help by having better directors, better trained directors, and by having a better composed, structured and trained board and a constantly evaluated and developed board. And I genuinely believe that we talk about, you know, all the things we need to do to improve our economy. If we did that one thing, improved directors, improved boards, that everything else would fall into place. Because you're not going to have a company who innovates or who internationalises if the boards don't think in a strategic, long-term way. And they're not going to, you know, as I say, do the things they need to do unless that board is right and is working in the right way. I think the nice thing, I suppose, there is a bit of empathy for that. There's not enough support behind it by a variety of organisations, but I mean, bluntly, because of the history of, for example, Rangers Football Club or Bank of Scotland and RBS, people in Scotland are really aware of corporate governance mm-hmm. and how boards weren't working.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. But what struck me recently is I thought it was quite interesting that in the workforce, quite often, small to medium-sized companies have quite a clear process in terms of how they manage someone's performance, and there's annual appraisals, for example. But actually, my experience at board level is that that's not always the case, and there's not necessarily appraisals, for example, of other board members.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that as a process?
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. One of the real problems is that people, and it even stretches like Skills Development Scotland, will find ways to develop apprentices. They don't, in my view, spend enough in the workforce, but they're looking at that. But nobody actually even lists anywhere money to support boards. And the assumption, I suppose, that all boards have got lots of money, which is simply not true, sort of thing. And most of the directors and many boards in Scotland, college boards, for example, are not paid. You know, so where's the budget to train them? So we really need to focus on how we train and develop these boards as well. So we need to put resources behind it. We need to emphasise importance of it for the individual and the group, and then put money behind it and actually deliver it. And there's not enough of that going on. There really isn't. We do quite a bit, to be fair, but there could be so much more done.
Because I was interested when I was looking at the Institute of Directors training courses that you do to see that you do have some courses there for board development.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of an uptake do you get on these courses, and what's the feedback?
On the whole, it's very good. We run a range of courses, just to explain. We're in a certificate diploma and chartered director qualification, which is for the individual, is a UK-wide course, and you become a chartered director, you go through the whole process. There's only a relatively small number of people done that, but we also run alongside that courses on the role of the non-exec director, on the role of the chairman, on the role of the trustee, and a lot also of, you know, leadership style sessions and stuff, and individual training courses ranging from presentation skills through to leadership skills.
My understanding is you've had sort of experience on both sides, you know, within private businesses and as a trustee. Just to get your take on it, has there been a difference for you in terms of that sector difference at that level?
Funny, I always say you learn almost astonishing things as a trustee or a non-exec director in a not-for-profit sector. I mean, I, for example, have been involved in a variety as a last line of appeal for grievance procedures. I've actually sacked two or three people when I was on that sort of board, been responsible for that or been involved in that, which I fortunately never had to do in my, you might say, paid work sort of thing.
Right.
So you do get a variety of real interesting challenges that come along, because typically that charity will not necessarily have its own HR department. It might have a CEO who's not particularly skilled in that area sort of thing, or in certain areas. So you have to almost fill in some of these gaps because there's very few resources. So it's a very interesting learning experience. I always recommend it to people, because this concept that, you know, it's not all about scale. Learning to be a board member, you can do in quite a small board. Probably my second board, but was a very small art charity. But when I went along to the first meeting, the chairwoman who'd invited me to join the board, she resigned, and I discovered they're bankrupt, sort of thing. So it taught me to do due diligence in the future, I've got to say. But also it's a great learning experience that I would never have got. So as a group, we got together, a new chairwoman who was brilliant, as it happens, and rebuilt the business. Got a great artistic director who drove the thing forward. So, you know, that was a learning experience that fortunately I never really faced in my own work.
Is there anything, just from your experience, that you think these early stage businesses should be considering when looking at putting their board together in terms of the makeup of the board, or even how to go about putting a board together?
Yeah. It's a really, really interesting point you make there, because actually I think one of the problems. You always say if you're going to lose your business, you probably lose it in the first 3 years. Mm-hmm. And part of that is a bit is of who's holding your hand. And I think if you can get a good non-executive director or non-executive chairman to come in at a very early stage, not necessarily in a paid basis. Lots of people who do it on a sweat equity basis and they promise they'll get some return if and when the business ever flies and makes money. So that's possible. And I think it's really important. It also gives you credibility with investors and things like that as well. But my attitude would always be you get one, two or maximum of three people engaged to help you. It depends on the size of the and the scale of the challenges you face. But I wouldn't go too big. I mean, probably one would be a good start, who come almost like a mentor chairman person as well. I think they're a good starting point as well. I do think not enough businesses or startups spin out, say, from university, mm-hmm. really go and look at that. Mm-hmm. They tend to leave that. But if you get your governance right, you get the right person early on, that will be the difference between life and death of your business.
And I'm just thinking from because I run a early stage business myself, is that if you've put a board together, which, for example, I've done with iMultiply, and I've selected really experienced non-exec board members, which is great for me, I think there's maybe an assumption that they don't need developed. You know, is there an argument to say, though, that even if you've got a really experienced board, that there still should be some sort of board development?
100%. And I mean, RBS had a lot of experienced non-exec directors when it went into the mess and cost us all £45 billion sort of thing. So experience doesn't mean you get all the right answers. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you know you need to know. I think that's particularly true in this technological age where things come and go. I mean, you know, the two biggest companies in the world in recent years are Airbnb and Uber, who don't own any cars and don't own any buildings, you know, completely change the model of how you do business. So these sort of things that can be facing you are really important. So I think social media, technological change alone are things that boards should at least discuss. So what I actually think that when you talk about training, you might think of bringing in somebody to facilitate a full day's learning, or it might just be bringing in somebody to facilitate an hour-long discussion on the Scottish economy and the public sector, if that's where you procure, for example. Or it's just mm-hmm. so it doesn't need to be formal training as such. It might even be over a glass of wine, but it's a structured conversation instead of just rambling on, and it is properly chaired and things like that as well.
Which is great, but I'm sure not everybody is like that. So I think, you know, people listening to this will probably be quite encouraged to think, well, actually, what is the review process? Yeah. Or have we got a commitment to each other? Mm. And do we ensure that we then carry that through?
Yeah. Again, I will absolutely should annually, at least, if not 6 months, have a serious look at what the board is doing. There's a terrible tendency to believe that board success is the same as company success. Now, the board should have its own set of objectives and its own set of behaviours that deliver what it's got to do to help with the company's success. It doesn't make the company success.
And how important is part of the board structure is diversity in the boardroom, do you think?
I think it's absolutely essential. And my favourite phrase, actually, I stole from Susan Rice recently, is cognitive diversity is what we need. And I think that's, and I'm going to keep branding that because I think it's absolutely right. Because I do think that having a set quota number of any men and women or anything, it mm-hmm. just doesn't work. The reason being it doesn't work, in my opinion, is because you do need diversity. So you do need, I think it's two things. You need to have some sort of, not representation, but reflection of your customer base. And I always quote Marks and Spencer's, a business who, last time I looked, had two women out of 14 members on the board. Their customer base is probably 85% women. So you immediately think, that's a bit unbalanced. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So you need to watch the numbers could come out. I think Marks and Spencer probably should have 12 women and 2 men sort of thing if you want to do that. So they get a better understanding. And people would say they haven't made the most of their business opportunities in recent years. And one of the reasons might well be that, for example. Added to that, I'm a very strong believer, especially as I mentioned social media earlier on, that you probably need somebody under 30 on your board who actually understands social media mm-hmm. and what young people, if that's your customer base, are doing in social media. So you probably need some young people. So you might also need, it would be helpful to somebody with a disability or somebody an ethnic minority or somebody who comes from a marketing background, somebody who comes from a legal background, somebody who comes from a financial background and, you know, a sales-focused background. So all these people, so if you start putting a number in any one part of that, it becomes a jigsaw puzzle and you don't end up with the best people. You end up with a higgledy-piggledy mess. We must have two women, must have two disabled people, must have two people from an ethnic minority. Well, it just gets silly. Bottom line is you have to pick the best people you can find to do the job.
I like that cognitive diversity. I think I'll use that as well, David.
Yeah,
I'll take that from you.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I guess the challenge is how do you engage some of these younger individuals, especially some individuals that might not feel that they have the confidence or experience to operate at board level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything that you think either the Institute of Directors could do or that we could all be doing as, you know, individuals within business to encourage?
We are looking to do different things all the time, and I think companies and organisations should do that. They should be looking at how they develop their talent for the future of the boardroom as well. I mean, we all try and develop managers of tomorrow, but should we not be developing the directors of tomorrow as well?
I love it. And on that note, I think that's a good note to end on, that you've given a lot of things to think about there. So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts.
Very pleased to do so. Always happy to talk about directors.
Well, I think you've left us with a lot to think about. So thank you. Thank you very much for joining us and listening to this podcast. If you want to stay in touch regarding business and recruitment news, please visit us at imultiplyresourcing.com.